Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering Kingston City Council's decision to rename Indian Road.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
After a long discussion at their June 17th meeting, Council ultimately voted to rename Indian Road. Indian Road runs through a residential community located in Strathcona Park with approximately 62 households. The motion claims the name is in violation of the Civic Addressing and Road Naming Bylaw, which prohibits names that are discriminatory, offensive, or derogatory. The motion was put forward by Councillor Gregory Ridge, prompted by a request from Indian Road resident Daniel Shipp. Shipp, who has lived on the street for nearly a decade, addressed council before their discussion.
In my opinion, the street name is not only outdated, it's offensive and derogatory. Due to its complex and often paternalistic colonial history, is very much out of step with our municipal street naming policy.
Brandon Miracle, executive director of Kingston Native Center and Language Nest, an organization that was consulted by Councillor Ridge, also spoke before council.
Anything that exists in culture and society is something that we interact with, whether Indigenous or not. I think, like I mentioned previous, Indian is a complicated one. And when you see that on a road sign, you're met with your entire context as you go into that. That could be that it's a legal term. That could be that you're excited because you use that term as a reclaimed word within community. Or, like I said, it could be a term of pain. Representing a community within Kingston from the Kingston Native Center and Language Nest, all those perspectives are seen. And so it's hard to... What I'm really excited about is the consultation process.
Councillor Ridge introduced the motion, leading with the results of his discussions with several local Indigenous organizations and Indian Road residents, and clarifying the intention of the change.
There are differing opinions on this matter, but the overwhelming majority of those who I had the honor of listening to were in favor and in support of this change. We must also be careful to continue listening and to continue to be supportive as we move forward. Finally, I want to mention something. This motion is not the result of liberal guilt, nor is it the result of wokeness. This motion is not intended to open a larger debate about naming public spaces, but instead to point to a singular matter that requires addressing. To the people who are concerned that we're trying to change history, we can't. Nobody can change history. But we can and must try to make today and tomorrow better for everybody in our community.
Strathcona Councillor Jeff McLaren, however, represented a different perspective. McLaren argued that the people who developed the area decades ago chose the name to recognize the contributions of Indigenous people in Canada, pointing to several other streets in the neighborhood referencing Indigenous history and culture, including Arrowhead Place and Mohawk Place. He also argued that the city has not done enough consultation on the matter and should take a step back before deciding if the name should be changed. At the start of the meeting, he presented a petition started by a resident against changing the name, which garnered 40 signatures from residents of the street. McLaren suggested 3 amendments to the motion.
So, this motion is before us now, even though I had hoped it would not be. And it is possible to make this supportable. There just are a few small changes that need to be made, I think, that would be more respectful and more in line with true reconciliation.
The first 2 amendments, which passed unanimously, were to consult a list of local Indigenous groups and First Nations with a connection to the area on the matter, and to ensure that the history behind Indian Road be preserved and commemorated in some way. However, his Third Amendment, suggesting they step back to consult further on whether the name should be changed at all, sparked more debate.
We cannot presume to know the answer to consultations before we do the consultation. This motion, as written, presumes that we're going to change the name because certain people that we've talked to already have said so. Perhaps the frame was correct, perhaps the frame was wrong. I don't know. But the consultation needs to be wide and far apart. If it comes back, having done that, that the majority want this changed, I will support that. But I support that theory that nothing about us without us should be first and primary. This is actually, in fact, how you build trust.
Councillor Connie Glenn supported the amendment.
Councillor Ridge has gone and talked to some people. Councillor McLaren has gone and talked to some people. I've heard some things. You've heard some things. So as we make this kind of a decision, because of the cultural impact, because of the sensitivity around it, I think maybe taking a step back to allow people to say, do we really consider this word this way? I'm hearing mixed things. So let's do a fulsome consultation and get it right.
Councillor Ridge and Councillor Brandon Tozzo, who seconded the motion, found this strayed too far from the original intention to move forward with the name change.
The amendment is contrary to the intention of the motion, which is to begin the renaming process. This is to change that to considering renaming. One may argue that actually could be called out of order, but I'm not going to do that.
I think this runs extremely contrary to that motion. And I think we kind of have to make a decision whether we want to go forward with this or whether we don't. And if we don't want to go forward with renaming the road, I think the option is just to vote it down. So I'm going to vote down this amendment.
The amendment was ultimately voted down, and the decision on whether to rename the road or leave it be was before council. Councillors McLaren and Glenn both agreed that satisfactory consensus has yet to be reached.
The answers that we're going to get have already been selected. It doesn't matter what Indigenous people now say. It doesn't matter what the residents now say. The motion has presumed that there's going to be a name change. And that is paternalistic.
It's a matter of how we go about doing this. And we have to consider the how as much as we consider the what. And maybe this is where this wasn't where we should have been. Maybe we should have had other conversations about it before the motion got to the floor. Maybe there should have been a broader bit of conversation between all of us about what this actually means. I actually think the likely outcome in the long run will be probably a name change, but one that the community will agree with. And consensus building matters in these situations. And I don't think that we're going to build consensus this way. I'm concerned, actually, that we might pit people against one another. So I think I'm going to vote against this motion on that basis alone, that if this how was different, I would have been able to support this.
However, Councillors Tozzo and Vincent Chinnani stressed the need to move forward.
There is a saying by an abolitionist that I rather like, that history, the arc of history is long and it bends towards justice. That's quite optimistic. I don't know if that's always true, because I think it needs to be nudged every now and again. And I think sometimes as political leaders, we have to take that risk and nudge it along the way and try to do the right thing and have some form of justice, however that may be.
So I am going to vote in favor of this because I think it's important to right wrongs that were done in the past, even though the intent was good. To me, it feels like in today's society, you have to make that change to move forward and then have, and so people can feel like they heal. I've talked to a lot of people, and this is a very derogatory word, and there was people surprised that this is even the name of a street here.
Ridge capped off the discussion reading a letter from a resident of Indian Road.
I am not a cancel culture person, and I am not saying that we need to pretend the word Indian doesn't exist. But what I do believe is that having a street in your city named after a word that has come to have derogatory connotation for most people is not a way to commemorate Indigenous history or celebrate current Indigenous communities. I fully support changing the name to something beautiful that has accurate historical and current meanings. I think what most residents are wary of are the administrative hurdles of changing everything related to your address. The city needs to walk residents through this and make it as streamlined and easy as possible. That inconvenience should not be a reason to keep the current name. I really see this as a microcosm of reconciliation in general. We should not be held back because the task seems too expensive or complicated. I love our street. It is home to wonderful people. I want a name that reflects this.
In the end, council voted 7-3 to rename the road. City staff will begin the consultation process for choosing a new name and report back by mid-2026. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about the end of the fire agreement between TLTI and the township of Front of Young.
Thank you, Jesse. The township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands is terminating a 23-year-old fire protection agreement with the township of Front of Young, citing overlapping service, limited benefits, and rising costs. At its June 16th meeting, Township Council unanimously approved a staff recommendation to provide 6 months' written notice to end the agreement, which was originally signed in 2001 and most recently cost the township over $38,000. Fire Chief Mike Pryor said TLTI firefighters were already responding to all the same calls as the Front of Young, despite the original agreement outlining a split in responsibilities. Under the existing deal, Front of Young was to respond to minor incidents like alarms and medical assists in Ward 3, while TLTI covered larger emergencies. However, both departments were regularly attending all incidents, with TLTI often arriving just minutes after Front of Young. Chief Pryor emphasized the township is exploring new ways to enhance local response, including a plan with fire underwriters survey to place a tanker in the F. Scott garage. While the formal agreement will end, the other township can still assist through mutual aid or future automatic aid agreement, similar to TLTI's arrangement with Gananoque, Kingston, Athens, and Rideau Lakes. Chief Pryor assured council and residents TLTI Fire Services would continue responding to all calls in Ward 3. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LGR reporter for the Napanee Beaver, Sarah Williams, covering some key developments from the latest Napanee Council meeting.
Thank you, Dinah. Here is a rundown of some key Napanee Council decisions from their last meeting. Disappointingly, Napanee will not be receiving grant money to support the rehabilitation of the Best and Bash soccer field. Councillors received a financial and IT services report noting their community sport and recreation infrastructure fund grant application had been denied. During 2025 budget deliberations, over $65,000 was earmarked as the municipal contribution to this rehabilitation project. Given the lack of grant money to cover the remaining cost of the project, Council has approved staff's recommendation that the municipal contribution be transferred from the levy to the working capital reserve. In other news, a new bylaw will regulate the Greater Napanee Fire Department. This new bylaw replaces the old one that was last updated 5 years ago. In light of the town's cybersecurity breach in January 2024 and, quote, evolving procedures at the U.S. border, staff have brought forward a report recommending they adopt a new U.S. cross-border cell phone policy. At this time, U.S. Customs and Border Protection officers have legal authority and have been exercising this authority to inspect electronic devices without a warrant. Naturally, this can expose sensitive data. With this in mind, the new policy would prohibit town-owned devices, many of which store municipal data, from crossing the U.S. border. This policy is directly influenced by advice from the Government of Canada to expect inspections of all devices at the southern border.
And thank you to Sarah Williams for that story. Now over to LJR reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about Loyalist Township's plan to construct a new skate park and pump track in Amherstview.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca. The John M. Parrott Center in Napanee has marked a notable shift in staff tenure. Along with more experienced staff retiring or going elsewhere, the center is now at a point of hiring external candidates directly into full-time roles. Director of the center, Angela Malcolm, describes the changes they've seen.
Of particular importance, I think, is the significant changes in our staffing levels at the home in terms of tenure. So a significant difference in the amount of time it takes for an employee to get to a full-time position. So historically, it took 10 years, and we heard lots about that. And now you can often walk into a full-time position. So we're seeing that in 2022, 29% of our staff had been with us for 2 years or less, but now that number has risen to 36%. And then for our longer term staff, the 10 years and over, and it's dropped from 41 down to 26%.
Malcolm noted how the center is dealing with these changes in regards to staff education.
It's a significant difference in the capacity and the skills. And so it's requiring a different sort of approach to our education. And we're starting maybe a little bit more of a foundational knowledge that we're trying to build with the staff. So it was just interesting when we were seeing all of the increase in staff saying there's so many new people and I don't know who this person is, and so that would be why.
Malcolm describes a new tool the center has brought in to make things easier as well.
We have started a new audit tracking tool that's instead of a manual system, we now have an electronic system, and so the labor involved in tracking our audits and analyzing the trends is going to be significantly easier for all of us.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about a new accessible play area in Cobourg.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. A new play space aimed at enhancing a child's interest in playing is now open in Cobourg. Five Counties Children's Center's new backyard project offers children and their families who have physical or developmental challenges an opportunity to play in a safe learning environment. I spoke with Dr. Beverly Dietz, an early childhood educator, researcher, and outdoor play specialist, about what makes this center so unique.
It is a place where all children and families will be included in outdoor play. It is a place where families can come and support their children in having experiences that are going to support them in developing that sense of wonder, the sense of security and curiosity that are foundational for later learning experiences when they go to school environments.
So we see that there's a swing, there's kind of like a rollway for bicycles. What would you say is the most exciting piece here?
Oh, I can't identify one piece as being most exciting. It's when we put it all together and when we see that there are loose parts where there are opportunities for children to have the freedom to explore and for them to be able to determine their own play opportunities. That's the exciting part, because there are many different spaces and places to experience, depending again on the children's interest, what triggers the children's sense of curiosity and wonderment.
So with this play area, how do you know how to design it, and what pieces you should be including for maximization?
Well, when we design play spaces, we look at it from the perspective, what will trigger opportunities for play? So that's why you see so many natural items in the environment. That's very important, because that is a very calming effect for children. When you see the grass, it is a very natural approach to support children in having their brains settle so that they can then engage in play. We look at it from the perspective of physical development. Where are the opportunities to come together with their peers? Where are there places where they're going to co-create with children and adults? How can they take this space and make it one thing today and something very different tomorrow? So it's the flexibility for children to scaffold their ideas and their learning.
So Lena, what makes this playground different than a regular playground at a public park or a school?
Because it is accessible. There are places, if children have mobility devices, they can move in the space without any difficulty. You see that on the tracks. You see that children, should they be in a wheelchair or using other mobility devices, they have the opportunity to partner with their friends and be on a swing. You see that children can actually enhance opportunities to experience music with the variety of materials that are available. So that is different from many of the playgrounds where there may be surfaces that are not conducive for children that have mobility challenges. When we look at it from the perspective of children that require enhancements to speech and language, this is the place in which they can gain those skills because there are options for them to play. And through play outdoors, they will have more interest actually in connecting language to their experiences.
Okay, so then when we see this playground and you're talking about accessibility, do you advocate that towards towns and municipalities to say this is the direction you should be going to include all children?
Yes, and it's not only children, it's families. So if you think of perhaps a mom or a dad that may use a wheelchair, they can now come to the play space with their children and feel part of the community. So that is very, very important. Or if you have grandparents or extended families, it now becomes a community space. Whereas many of the playgrounds, the municipal playgrounds, do not offer that. You have to be able to walk to get into the spaces. This allows everyone to be able to come and to participate in some way. You know, when we look at seniors, there are things here that seniors would want to engage with. And we want seniors to do that because we want intergenerational learning. That's what this space gives us.
So I understand you've been with Five Counties for the last few days talking to staff. What has been your message to staff here?
Well, I really have to say to you, I've been here before anything was here. I've been out when the grass was 3 feet high as we looked at this a few years ago. My message, however, over the last couple of days has been to really understand how we set up spaces for children to have that sense of wonderment and curiosity, and how the spaces are changed on an ongoing basis to continue to spark opportunities for children to want to play and to expand their desire to be outdoors in this space.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is the Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, June 26th, we have a daytime high of 23, but a 60% chance of precipitation, which is expected to cool conditions slightly here in the city of Kingston. That rain will give way to thunderstorms on Friday, June 27th. Same daytime high of 23 degrees, but a 70% chance of precipitation and thunderstorms into the afternoon. We're going to see a potential for thunderstorms on Saturday, June 28th, same daytime high of 23, and about a 60% chance of storms throughout the day. Moving towards the end of the weekend, Sunday, June 29th, conditions warm up slightly, going back to 25 degrees, and we're going to see a lot of cloud cover here in the city of Kingston. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, June 30th, daytime high of 24 degrees with a 70% chance of precipitation.
This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. The LaSalle Causeway's summer and fall closure schedule has been updated by Public Services and Procurement Canada. Reminder that the summer dates of the LaSalle Causeway's closure are as follows: July 1st, 6th, 13th, 20th, and 27th, August 3rd, 10th, 17th, 24th, and 31st, and September 7th, the causeway will be closed from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. on each of those summer dates. As for the fall, the current dates are September 21st, October 5th, 14th, and 19th, and November 2nd and 16th, the time of closure being 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. on each of those dates. Here are this week's relevant road closures. Albert Street, Princess to Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Aberdeen Street, William to Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Berry Street, Queen to Colborn is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. South Bartlett Street, Smith to Victoria is closed until August 29 for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen is closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Victoria Street, Union to Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. And Victoria Street, Princess to North Bartlett is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Here are some ongoing delays to be aware of. Abbeydon Road, Middle to Highway 2, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Bayridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Collins Bay Road, Woodbine to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work on Collins Bay Road. Florida Road, Henderson to Wilton, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle, expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead structure. Montreal Street at John Counter, expect delays for upgrades to the intersection including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users and to accommodate increased traffic from the Wabin Crossing. Victoria Street and Earl Street, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction for sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.